feel, the moment I don't feel that tranquility. Now, what I have to present this afternoon is a personal autopsy with the vertical pronoun I used as a scalpel. Can you hear me back there? No? I'll get nearer. All right. I began my life in England, and as I look back upon a rather long past, I cannot recall any time when I spoke fluently, either on the far side of the ocean or on the near side. Can you get that? Better? As a small child, I must have had more than a normal share of non-fluency. There were, as I recall, alternating phases of organization and disorganization of my speech, so that the impediment came and went. There was no definite point of onset of the stuttering or stammering. There were several onsets. Now that, I think, isn't a bit uncommon. Meanwhile, however, I was carefree and unconcerned, and I was no more bothered about my speech than I was by dirty hands. But there was a good deal of speech consciousness and anxiety by the time I reached the third or fourth grade. I recalled an examination in oral reading when the school principal came to the classroom and had each child stand and read by turn. I could see my turn coming and I could feel my apprehension mounting. Yet, surprising to me at that time, I read well, and the principal commended me with the word good. Logically, my apprehension should have subsided, but actually it increased. Eventually, I developed a phobia for a large vocabulary of words and a phobia for many speech situations. Am I getting this to the back of the room? No, no protests. Logically, my apprehension should have subsided, but actually it increased, and I mentioned the phobia for words and the phobia for speech situations. Now, when I blocked completely, and I was quite helpless in these situations. My escape in school was quite easy. I simply said I didn't know. Then I had to know a good deal in the written examinations. And now the approach to the speech problem. My parents were kindly and helpful, but during my last year in high school, they arranged, at my urging, for me to take a term out of school and to attend a so-called stammering school. This was the Beasley School, and one of the London schools, which was quite outstanding then. It was commercial, but ethical. The therapy which the school employed probably had its origin with Charles Kingsley and Erasmus Darwin. The principles were the deep breath and light articulation. I attended the Beasley School for 3 months and attained some slight improvement in speech, but unfortunately this improvement was very, very transient. A few years later, but while still in England, I happened to learn of the Lewis School in Detroit and of the fact that the school guaranteed to cure stammering. Now this sounded very promising, and accordingly I came to this country and enrolled in the school. It didn't take long to discover that Lewis was a quack. The system, as many of you know, was based on rhythm, and it was an adaptation of Columba's orthophonic system introduced in France in 1930. Lewis called his system the phonometric system, and it consisted in beating time and speaking a syllable to every beat. The resultant speech was quite abnormal, and very few of the pupils were willing to follow the system outside the school. It was during my stay in Detroit that I learned of Colorado and its dry air and sunshine, and since I was bothered by asthma, I spent a few months in Denver before returning to England. Later in England, I attended the Alfred Apple School in Manchester. The principle of therapy at the school was solely that of relaxation. We relaxed in armchairs and talked with the utmost nonchalance. Now, this worked well in the classroom, but unfortunately, we could not take the armchairs out onto the street. I mentioned my early experiences with the commercial standard schools in order to emphasize the change that has come, has taken place in the speech field. The Stanley schools are now nearly gone, and the problem of speech disorders is in the hands of the colleges and universities. This is a major change in social progress. But to get back to my personal autopsy, it was largely my indignation with the quacks and my experience with guaranteed cures that brought me into the speech field. I came back to Colorado because of the climate, and while working in psychology at the University of Colorado, I read everything I could find in English, French, and German on speech disorders. And I found, however, that this field of speech disorders was dim and hazy, and that if I was going to find any help for my speech, I had better strike out for myself. Accordingly, I decided to go into medicine and to progress from psychology to psychiatry. I am sure that I was obsessive compulsive in these endeavors, otherwise I would have given up the study of speech disorders long ago. Economically, my professional field has been that of clinical psychiatry, but I have always maintained an interest in the speech field, and I've worked in the Denver budget schools, and from time to time I've had groups of stammers under my care. Incidentally, I've never charged the people for these services. Working in the speech field, I have been able to clarify my thinking on the speech problem. My main conclusion is that the stutterer or the stammerer is a poorly integrated person, and that this situation reflects itself in the poor organization of his basic speech. His speech skill appears to be inferior even when he's not stammering. If we appraise the speech skill of the professional radio commentator, such as Ed Murrow, we would give him a grade of 100%. We would probably assign the average speaker a grade of 75 to 80%. But the stutter or stammer would not exceed, I think, 60%. And since the speech is poorly organized, it readily becomes disorganized under stress, and it breaks down into patterns of speech blocks and repetitions. This concept naturally affects the theory of therapy. The common concept regarding speech, and one that I hold myself for half a century, is that if one could remove the stammering, you would find a normal pattern of speech underlying it. This is the old concept of cure. A more realistic concept, as I see the problem, is that the stammer speech was never securely organized in childhood, and that it must be reorganized if fluency is to be attained. And how does speech become organized? Manifestly, a child learns through the ear, and when he talks, he recalls what the ear has heard. If he is born deaf, he has no speech at all. On the other hand, when he has normal hearing, his outer speech corresponds to the inner speech. He speaks French, German, English, Chinese, or Choctaw according to the language he hears. And if he hears Oxford English, he will think and speak Oxford English. In other circumstances, he speaks Cockney English, or Brooklynese, or Tennessee English. And if later he is going to speak a foreign language, he will have to learn to think the foreign language. In short, oral speech is patterned by the mental speech. Let me take a simple illustration of this principle of word thinking. My flight to Cincinnati was via Chicago, and the departure of the plane from Denver was called quite slowly and clearly so it could be heard all over the airport. Thusly, United Airlines main line of service for Chicago and Washington, flight 728, now ready at the South Concourse. All aboard, please. Now, why does the speech come so clearly from the loudspeaker? Because it goes so clearly into the microphone. And how do the words happen to be so slow and clear at the speaker's lips? Obviously, because they are slow and clear in the speaker's mind. This, I think, is a basic principle in the psychology of speech. Speaking is the process of thinking out loud. The mind broadcasts to the mouth, and the words more or less say themselves. Hence, the pattern of word thinking determines the pattern of word talking. And if the speech is served as word salad, it is first passed in the mixing bowl, which is just above the ears. And sometimes when the bowl is empty, the stammerer stands mute, with or without the struggle to articulate. However, the mixing bowl can be converted into a control center, and then the control thinking leads to clear and concise speech. I derive my concepts of the psychology of speech largely from playing with foreign languages. When I studied French and German, I was taught that one pronounced the U sound, as in German tu and view, and the German über, by rounding the lips, and both say U, and then switching off and saying E. Now, manifestly, such a procedure is impractical. One thinks two vowels in order to say one. Actually, one says the foreign speech sounds just as he hears them. To illustrate this point further, if you are in an English restaurant and you want a table napkin, you ask for a serviette, certainly a French term. But if you ask for a serviette in France, it becomes une serviette. In Germany, it is eine Serviette, and a Z sound replaces the S. In Spain, it becomes una servilleta, and there is a Y sound in the middle of the word. Now, all this requires precise word thinking rather than precise articulation. Here, let me be quite frank and say that I am not a linguist. I am doing very well if I can talk English. But I have been able to understand the mental processes of speech in trying to learn some of the rudiments of other languages. And of course, the principle of word thinking is important in English speech. We say all's well or all's swell according to the word thinking. And if we speak of housing the dog in the house, we have to think the fine shades of word values. Thus, my thesis is that effective speech correction takes place just above the ears and not just above the chin. Speech correction deals more with the psychology of speech than with the physiology of speech. For myself, I wasted decades learning the physiology of speech with upper chest breathing, intercostal breathing, diaphragmatic breathing, and vocalization, the coupe de la glotte and the glide of the glottis, light articulation, firm articulation, and so forth. But all of this proved futile. The speech centers are not in the chest or the vocal cords of the lips, they're in the mind. As I see the problem, one thinks one's way into clear speech, one does not breathe one's way into it. I was slow to fathom these concepts, and I did not effect major improvement in my speech till I reached 60 years of age. This is late in life, but not too late for speech improvement to be acceptable. On the basis of my own experience and my experience with other stammers, let me urge that we give less attention to the stammer's symptoms and more attention to his basic speech. Here I would like to recall an old story to your minds. A patient went to the doctor with a sprained wrist. The doctor applied a light cast and then the patient asked him, "Doctor, when you take the cast off, will I be able to play the violin?" "Yes," said the doctor, "sure you'll be able to play the violin. You'll have no trouble at all." "Well, that's fine," said the patient. "I never could before." Now, here we identify a basic fallacy, as I see it, in our concept of speech therapy. We try to remove the stammering, and we expect to find a normal pattern of speech underlying it. Yet there never was a dependable pattern of fluency in the stammerer's speech. His stammering appeared when he was 3 or 4 years old, and his speech was never organized. If we remove the impediment, just the doctor would remove the cast, we certainly would not find a normal condition underlying it. As I view the problem, the stammerer has to reorganize his speech by reorganizing his verbal thinking. He can do this in speech therapy, or if he is resourceful, he can do this for himself. Other procedures, of course, can be effective. Even a Tard's tongue fork or the old German tongue nerve powders would be helpful if the stammerer had confidence in them. The confidence would allay the fear, and this would calm the mind and augment the clarity of thinking. Yet I think the approach would be more direct if the stammerer realized that speech improvement is found more easily in the mind than in the mouth.